Enjoy Your Symptom, Jacques Lacan in Hollywood and Out by Slavoj Žižek. Preface to the Routledge Classics edition. Enjoy Your Symptom or Your Fetish. There are two ways to understand the thesis that we live in a post-ideological world. Either we take it in a naive post-political sense, finally liberated from the burden of great ideological narratives and causes, we can dedicate ourselves to solving pragmatically real problems, or, in a more critical way, as a sign of today's predominant cynicism. Today's power no longer needs a consistent ideological edifice to legitimate its rule. It can afford to state directly the obvious truth, search for profits, brutal imposition of economic interests. According to the second reading, there is no longer a need for refined procedure of ideologie critique, for a symptomal reading that detects the false in an ideological edifice. Such a procedure knocks on an open door, since the thoroughly cynical power discourse concedes all this in advance, like today's analysant who calmly accepts the analyst's suggestions about his innermost obscene desire, no longer being shocked by anything. Is this, however, effectively the case? If it is, then ideologie critique and psychoanalysis are today ultimately of no use, since the wager of their interpretative procedure is that the subject cannot openly admit and really assume the truth about what she or he is doing. However, psychoanalysis opens up a way to unmask this apparent proof of its uselessness by way of detecting beneath the deceiving openness of post-ideological cynicism the contours of fetishism, and thus to oppose the fetishist mode of ideology, which predominates in our allegedly post-ideological era, to its traditional symptomal mode, in which the ideological lie which structures our perception of reality is threatened by symptoms, qua returns of the repressed, cracks in the fabric of the ideological lie. Fetish is effectively a kind of envers of the symptom, that is to say, symptom is the exception which disturbs the surface of the false appearance, the point at which the repressed big other scene erupts, while fetish is the embodiment of the lie which enables us to sustain the unbearable truth. Let us take the case of the death of a beloved person. In the case of a symptom, I repress this death. I try not to think about it, but the repressed trauma returns in the symptom. In the case of a fetish, on the contrary, I rationally, fully accept this death. And yet I cling to the fetish, to some feature that embodies for me the disavowal of this death. In this sense, a fetish can play a very constructive role of allowing us to cope with a harsh reality. Fetishists are not dreamers lost in their private worlds. They are thoroughly realists, able to accept the way things effectively are, since they have their fetish to which they can cling in order to cancel the full impact of reality. There is a wonderful early short story by Patricia Highsmith, Button, about a middle-class New Yorker who lives with a mongoloid, a 9-year-old son who babbles meaningless sounds all the time and smiles while saliva is running out of his open mouth. One late evening, unable to endure the situation, he decides to take a walk on the lone Manhattan streets, where he stumbles upon a destitute homeless beggar who pleadingly extends his hand towards him. In an act of inexplicable fury, the hero beats the beggar to death and tears off from his jacket a button. Afterwards, he returns home a changed man, enduring his family nightmare without any traumas, capable of even a kind smile towards his mongoloid son. He keeps this button all the time in the pocket of his trousers, a perfect fetish, the embodied disavowal of his miserable reality, the constant reminder that, once at least, he did strike back against his miserable destiny. In psychiatric circles, there is a story told about a man whose wife was diagnosed with acute breast cancer and died 3 months afterwards. The husband survived her death unscathed, being able to talk coolly about his traumatic last moments with her. How? Was he a cold, distant monster with no feelings? Soon his friends noticed that while talking about his deceased wife, he always held in his hands a hamster, her pet object, his fetish, the embodied disavowal of her death. No wonder that, when a couple of months later the hamster died, the guy broke down and had to be hospitalized for a long period, treated for acute depression. So when we are bombarded by claims that in our post-ideological cynical era, nobody believes in the proclaimed ideals, when we encounter a person who claims he is cured of any beliefs, accepting social reality the way it really is, one should always counter such claims with the question, okay, but where is your hamster? The fetish which enables you to pretend to accept reality the way it is. 2. The way I proceed to analyze this impregnation of our daily lives by ideology is through the reference to numerous examples. So a note about my often criticized use of examples is perhaps appropriate here. The difference between the idealist and the materialist use of examples is that in the Platonic idealist approach, examples are always imperfect. They never perfectly render what they are supposed to exemplify, so that we could take care not to take them too literally. While for a materialist, there is always more in the example than in what it exemplifies. In other words, an example always threatens to undermine what it is supposed to exemplify, since it gives body to what the exemplified notion itself represses, is unable to cope with. Therein resides Hegel's materialist procedure in his phenomenology. Each figure of consciousness is first staged, exemplified, and then undermined through its own example. This is why the idealist approach always demands a multitude of examples. Since no single example is fully fitting, one has to enumerate them to indicate the transcendent wealth of the idea they exemplify, the idea being the fixed point of reference of the floating examples. A materialist, on the contrary, tends to repeat one and the same example, to return to it obsessively. It is the particular example which remains the same in all symbolic universes, while the universal notion it is supposed to exemplify continually changes its shape, so that we get a multitude of universal notions circulating like flies around the light, around a single example. Is this not what Lacan is doing, returning to the same exemplary cases, the guessing game with five hats, the dream of Irma's injection, each time providing a new interpretation? Such an example is the universal singular, a singular entity which persists as the universal in the multitude of its interpretations. In a recent conversation, Hanif Qureshi was telling me about his new novel, whose narrative is different from what he wrote hitherto. I ironically asked him, but the hero is nonetheless an immigrant with a Pakistani father who is a failed writer, he replied. What's the problem? Do we not all have Pakistani fathers who are failed writers? He was right, and this is what Hegel meant by singularity elevated into universality. The pathological twist that Hanif Qureshi experienced in his father is part of every father. There is no normal father. Everybody's father is a figure who failed to live up to his mandate and thus left to his son the task to settle his symbolic debts. In this sense, again, Qureshi's Pakistani failed writer is a universal singular, a singular standing in for the universality. This is what hegemony is about. This short circuit between the universal and its paradigmatic case. In the precise Kuhnian sense of the term, it is not enough to say that Kudishis's own case is one in the series of the cases exemplifying the universal fact that father is yet another impossible profession. One should make a step further and claim that precisely we all have Pakistani fathers who are failed writers. In other words, let us imagine being a father as a universal ideal, which all empirical fathers endeavor to approach and ultimately fail to do. What this means is that the true universality is not that of the ideal being a father, but that of failure itself. Therein resides today's true impasse of paternal authority, in the biological father's growing reluctance to accept the symbolic mandate, father. This impasse is the secret motif that runs through Steven Spielberg's films. All his key films, E.T., Empire of the Sun, Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, are variations on this motif. One should remember that the family to whose small boy E.T. appears was deserted by the father, as we learn in the very beginning, so that E.T. is ultimately a kind of vanishing mediator who provides a new father, the good scientist who in the film's last shot is already seen embracing the mother. When the new father is here, E.T. can leave and go home. Empire of the Sun focuses on a boy deserted by his family in the war-torn China and surviving through the help of an ersatz father played by John Malkovich. In the very first scene of Jurassic Park, we see the paternal figure played by Sam Neill jokingly threatening the two kids with a dinosaur bone. This bone is clearly the tiny object stain which later explodes into gigantic dinosaurs, so that one can risk the hypothesis that within the film's phantasmatic universe, the dinosaur's destructive fury merely materializes the rage of the paternal superego. A barely perceptible detail that occurs later, in the middle of the film, confirms this reading. The pursued group of Neil with two kids take refuge from the murderous carnivorous dinosaurs in a gigantic tree, where death-tired they fall asleep. On the tree, Neil loses the dinosaur bone that was stuck in his belt, and it is as if this accidental loss has a magic effect. Before they fall asleep, Neil is reconciled with the children, displaying warm affection and care for them. Significantly, the dinosaurs who approach the tree next morning and awaking the sleeping party turn out to be of the benevolent herbivorous kind. Schindler's List is, at the most basic level, a remake of Jurassic Park, and, if anything, worse than the original. With the Nazis as the dinosaur monsters, Schindler as, at the film's beginning, the cynical profiteering and opportunistic parental figure, and the ghetto Jews as threatened children. Their infantilization in the film is eye-striking. The story the film tells is about Schindler's gradual rediscovery of his paternal duty towards the Jews, and his transformation into a caring and responsible father, and is The War of the Worlds not the last installment of this saga. Tom Cruise plays a divorced working-class father who neglects his two children. The invasion of the aliens reawakens in him the proper paternal instinct, and he rediscovers himself as a caring father. No wonder that, in the last scene, he finally gets the recognition from his son, who, throughout the film, despises him. In the mode of the 18th century stories, the film could thus also have been subtitled A Story of How a Working Father Finally Gets Reconciled with His Son. One can effectively imagine the film without the bloodthirsty aliens. What remains is, in a way, what the film really is about. The story of a divorced working-class father who strives to regain the respect of his two children. And one can easily repeat this mental experiment apropos Spielberg's other films. Jurassic Park is a film about a father on a trip through wild nature with the two children where they resolve their tensions. E.T. is a film about a frustrated boy in a family abandoned by the father, etc. Of course, one can argue that such a reading is too naively Freudian in the way it reduces the foreign element, aliens, dinosaurs, to a metaphor for family tensions, ignoring the metonymic level of monsters as imminent prolongation of humans, not only their metaphor. However, the answer to this approach is that such a Freudian reduction is a feature of films themselves, its imminent ideology. Therein resides the film's ideology with regard to the two levels of the story, the Oedipal level of the lost and regained paternal authority, the spectacular level of the conflict with the invading aliens. There is a clear dissymmetry, since the Oedipal level is what the story is really about. While the external spectacular is merely its metaphoric extension. There is a nice detail in the film's soundtrack which makes clear the predominance of this Oedipal dimension. The aliens' attacks are accompanied by a terrifying one-note low trombone sound weirdly resembling the low bass and trumpet sound of the Tibetan Buddhist chant. The voice of the suffering, dying, evil father, in clear contrast to the beautiful five tones melodic fragment that identifies the good aliens in Spielberg's Encounters of the Third Kind. 3. But is the ultimate goal of the analysis of ideology not practical, to enable us to intervene and change our reality? Does my jumping from one to another example not contradict this professed goal, condemning us to narcissistic pleasure in theory and thus effectively sabotaging the urgency of practical engagement? A fake sense of urgency pervades the left liberal humanitarian discourse. Recall a rhetorical figure such as "a woman is raped every 6 seconds in this country," or "in the time it takes you to read this paragraph, 10 children will die of hunger." Underlying all this is a sentiment of moral outrage. This pseudo-urgency was exploited by Starbucks a couple of years ago when, at the entrance, posters greeted customers pointing out that half or so of their profits went to the health care of the children of Guatemala, from where their coffee originates, so that with every cup you drank, you, so to speak, saved a child's life. There is a fundamental anti-theoretical edge to it. The underlying point is here, no time to reflect on all of it, we have to act now. See against this Marx's wonderful letter to Engels from 1870, when for a brief moment it seemed that a European revolution was again at the gates. In this letter he conveys his sheer panic. Counter-revolutionaries wait for a couple of years since he, Marx, had not yet finished his Capital. Through this fake sense of urgency, the post-industrial rich, living in their secluded virtual world, not only do not deny or ignore the harsh reality outside their area, they actively refer to it all the time. As Bill Gates recently put it, "What do computers matter when millions are still unnecessarily dying of diarrhea?" Nothing demonstrates better the fake nature of this sense of urgency than the reverberations of the cover story of the Time magazine in the summer of 2006, reporting that around 4 million people died there as a result of political violence in the last decade and no usual humanitarian uproar followed, as if some kind of filtering mechanism blocks these news from achieving their full impact on our symbolic space. The Congo is today effectively re-emerging as a Conradian heart of darkness that no one dares fully to confront. Do we need more proofs that the humanitarian sense of urgency is mediated / overdetermined by clear political considerations? Which considerations? To answer this question, we need precisely to step back and take a look. When in a critical analysis of the present global constellation, one offers no clear solution, no practical advice on what to do, when one paints no light at the end of the tunnel, well aware that this light might belong to a train crashing towards us, one is usually reproached. So, what should we do? Nothing. Just sit and wait? One should gather the courage to answer, yes, precisely that. There are situations where the only truly practical thing to do is to resist the temptation to engage immediately and to wait and see, by means of a patient critical analysis. Engagement seems to exert its pressure on us from all directions. In a well-known passage from his Existentialism is Humanism, Sartre deployed the dilemma of a young man in France in 1942, torn between the duty to help his lone, ill mother and the duty to enter resistance and fight the Germans. Sartre's point is, of course, that there is no a priori answer to this dilemma. The young man should make a decision grounded only in his own abyssal freedom, assuming full responsibility for it. An obscene third way out of this dilemma would have been to advise the young man to tell his mother that he will join the resistance and to tell his resistance friends that he will take care of his mother, while in reality withdrawing to a secluded place and studying. There is more than cheap cynicism in this advice. It brings to mind a well-known Soviet joke about Lenin. Under socialism, Lenin's words to young people, his answer to what they should do, learn, learn, and learn, were evoked all the time, displayed on all school walls. So here is how the joke goes. Marx, Engels, and Lenin are asked what they would prefer to have, a wife or a mistress. As expected, Marx, rather conservative in private matters, answers a wife, while Engels, more of a bon vivant, opts for a mistress. However, to everyone's surprise, Lenin says, "I would like to have both of them." Why? Is there a hidden strike of decadent jouisseur to his austere revolutionary image? No, he explains. So that I can tell my wife that I am going to my mistress and my mistress that I have to be with my wife. And then what do you do? I go to a lone place to learn, learn, and learn. Is this not exactly what Lenin did after the catastrophe of 1914? He withdrew to a lone place in Switzerland where he learned, learned, and learned, reading Hegel's logic, and perhaps this is what we should do today. Introduction to the new revised edition, From Desire to Drive and Back. The present book was first published in 1992 as an attempt to introduce the doctrine of Jacques Lacan to the American public via Hollywood cinema. How are we to judge the receptivity of American academia to Lacan now, almost 10 years later? One of the stories that snobbish French Lacanians like to quote against translating jouissance as enjoyment, with of course an undertone of French arrogance and a patronizing stance towards the American scene, is that Lacan, on his first visit to the United States, watched in Baltimore a TV commercial with the motto "Enjoy Coke," and dismayed at its vulgarity, emphatically claimed that his jouir is not this enjoy. Against this argument, one should claim that enjoy in the unfortunate enjoy coke precisely is the jouir in its super ego imbecility. What better example of Lacan's thesis that super ego is an injunction to enjoy than enjoy coke? Is there, then, a hope for the breakthrough of Lacanian theory in the United States? Whatever the vicissitudes and deformations of Lacan in cultural studies, one should focus on what happens with children in their early age. following the wise Jesuit motto, give me a child till he is 7, and afterwards you can do with him whatever you want. So I am tempted to claim that there is hope for us Lacanians as long as American children are massively exposed to Shel Silverstein's 2 classic books, The Missing Piece and The Missing Piece Meets the Big O. One is almost embarrassed by the direct way these 2 books render in naked form the basic matrix of the Lacanian opposition of desire and drive. The first book tells of the adventures of an it, a circle with a point for an eye, and a triangular gap for a mouth, a subject in search of a missing piece that would fill in the gap and thus change it into a complete circle, somewhat like the perfect spheric human being preceding sexual difference from Plato's Symposium. It was missing a piece, and it was not happy. So it set off in search of its missing piece, and as it rolled it sang this song, oh, I'm looking for my missing piece, I'm looking for my missing piece, hi-de-ho, here I go, looking for my missing piece. So after a long journey full of adventurous encounters, one day it finds a triangular missing piece that will fill its void. However, the piece tells him, wait a minute, I'm not your missing piece. I'm nobody's piece. I am my own piece. And even if I was somebody's missing piece, I don't think I'd be yours. So it sadly rolls on, finds another piece that is too small, another that is too big, another too sharp, another too square, another that it doesn't hold tightly enough and thus loses, another that it holds too tightly and thus breaks. Finally, it encounters a triangular piece that seems to be just right and asks, are you anybody else's missing piece? The piece answers, not that I know of. Well, maybe you want to be your own piece. I can be someone's and still be my own. So they get together and they fit perfectly, forming a perfect sphere. Because it is now complete, it rolls faster and faster. But for that reason it cannot smell a flower or talk to a worm. Could it still sing? It began to sing, I've thrown my missing geese, I've thrown my missing breeze. Now that it was complete, it could not sing at all. So it stopped rolling, set the piece down gently, rolled away and started to sing softly. Oh, I'm looking for my missing piece, I'm looking for my missing piece. It is the paradox of desire at its purest. In order to sustain itself as desire, to articulate itself in a song, a piece must be missing. Do we not have here the matrix of Robert Schumann's tragedy? His fate was the opposite of a standard lover caught in an unhappy love affair and dreaming about happy unification with his beloved. His deadlock was that his wishes were realized, life spared him the disappointment of unhappy love, so that his position was that of a lover united forever with his beloved and dreaming about some new obstacle that would make the beloved distant. It is no wonder that the outcome was a psychotic breakdown. Things were far more beautiful when one imagined them breaking, Schumann would say to himself. Was not the mere idea of a possible setback more agreeable than the certainty of familiar things? The trajectory of Freud's and Lacan's theory goes from desire to drive. It is no surprise then that the missing piece, which narrates the myth of how the it, the Lacanian lamella, constitutes itself as desiring subject through a lack, was followed 6 years later by The Missing Piece Meets the Big O, which tells the story, as it were, from the opposite end, not from the standpoint of the desiring subject looking for its missing piece, but from the standpoint of the missing piece itself. This piece is not a Freudian partial object satisfied to remain its own piece, like the first piece encountered by the it in the first book, but a piece that is sitting alone, waiting for someone to take it. Here, of course, problems emerge. Some who come along fit but cannot roll. Others can roll but do not fit. Some are too delicate, some put a piece on a pedestal and leave it there. Some have too many pieces missing, some have too many pieces, period. Some look too closely at the piece, while others roll by without even noticing it. The piece tries to make itself more attractive, but it doesn't help. It tries being flashy, but this just frightens away the shy ones. At last, one it comes along that fits just right, looking like the it from the first book. So as in the first book, they form a perfect sphere and start to roll happily. However, once inserted into it, the missing piece begins to grow and grow. The it drops the piece out and goes away, complaining, "I'm looking for my missing piece, one that won't increase." Then one day an it comes along that looks different, a perfect circle in itself. The piece, a good Lacanian partial object, asks the it the obvious que voi question. What do you want of me? Nothing, is the answer. What do you need from me? Asks the piece, putting its bets on the distinction between demand and need. Again, nothing. Who are you? I am the big O. In short, a primordial, non-castrated big other who as such wants nothing. Maybe I am your missing piece, asks the piece, to which the big O answers, but I am not missing a piece. There is no place you would fit. That is too bad, says the missing piece. I was hoping that perhaps I could roll with you. You cannot roll with me, says the big O, but perhaps you can roll by yourself. By myself, a missing piece cannot roll by itself. Have you ever tried? But I am not shaped for rolling. Corners wear off and shapes change, says the big O, and rolls away. Alone again, the missing piece lifts itself, flops over, and slowly learns to roll. Its edges begin to wear off, and soon it goes on carelessly rolling instead of bouncing, rejoining the big O, accompanying it, attached to it as a small sphere on the border of the larger sphere. The small other clinging like a parasite to the big other, the two together forming a perfect example of the inner eight, the matrix of the self-perpetuating repetitious circulation of the drive. Apart from some minor corrections of typographical errors, the big difference between the first and this edition of the book is a new substantial final chapter, focusing on the phantasmatic support of the notion of reality. Since my standard book formula is for a length of 6 chapters, and since the book had in its first edition only 5 chapters, it is only now, after a delay of 8 years, that Enjoy Your Symptom effectively became my book. Introduction. I have always found extremely repulsive the common practice of sharing the main dishes in a Chinese restaurant. So when recently I gave expression to this repulsion and insisted on finishing my plate alone, I became the victim of an ironic wild psychoanalysis on the part of my table neighbor. Is not this repulsion of mine, this resistance to sharing a meal, a symbolic form of the fear of sharing a partner, that is, of sexual promiscuity? The first answer that came to my mind, of course, was a variation on the Quincy's caution against the art of murder. The true horror is not sexual promiscuity, but sharing a Chinese dish. How many people have entered the way of perdition with some innocent gangbang, which at the time was of no great importance to them, and ended by sharing the main dishes in a Chinese restaurant? Such a shift of accent, an exemplary case of what Freud called displacement, underlies the comical effect of understatement, allegedly characteristic of the English sense of humor and so much admired by Hitchcock. Yet we are here far from indulging in affected wisecracking. The point is rather that this the Quinician displacement enables us to discern the logic of a split which, as a kind of fatal flaw, is at work in the Enlightenment from its very beginning. That is to say, when in his programmatic text What is Enlightenment, Immanuel Kant provides the famous definition of enlightenment as man's release from his self-incurred tutelage, that is, his courage to make use of his understanding without direction from another. He supplements the motto, argue freely, by argue as much as you will and about what you will, but obey. This and not do not obey but argue is, according to Kant, the Enlightenment's answer to the demand of traditional authority, do not argue but obey. We must be careful here not to miss what Kant is aiming at. He is not simply restating the common motto of conformism. In private, think whatever you want, but in public, obey the authorities. But rather its opposite. In public, as a scholar before the reading public, use your reason freely. Yet in private, at your post in your family, that is, as a cog in the social machine, obey authority. This split underlies the famous Kantian conflict of the faculties between the faculty of philosophy, free to indulge in arguing about what it will, yet for that reason cut off from social power, the performative force of its discourse being, so to speak, suspended, and the faculties of law and theology, which articulate the principles of ideological and political power and are therefore devoid of the freedom to argue. The same split occurs already in Descartes, who, prior to entering the way of universal doubt, established a provisional morality, a set of rules regulating his everyday existence for the time of his philosophical journey. The very first rule emphasizes the need to obey the customs and laws of the country into which he was born without questioning their authority. In short, I am free to entertain doubts about anything, about the very existence of the universe, yet for all that I am compelled to obey the master, or as the Quincean version of it would run, how many people have entered the way of perdition with some innocent doubt about the existence of the world around them, which at the time was of no great importance to them, and ended by treating their superiors with insufficient respect. The ideological attitude opened up by this split, of course, is that of cynicism, of cynical distance, which pertains to the very notion of enlightenment and which today seems to have reached its apogee. Although officially undermined, devalorized, authority returns through the side door. We know there is no truth in authority, yet we continue to play its game and to obey it in order not to disturb the usual run of things. Truth is suspended in the name of efficiency. The ultimate legitimization of the system is that it works. In Eastern Europe's now defunct, really existing socialism, the split was that between a public ritual of obedience and private cynical distance. Whereas in the West, the cynicism is in a way redoubled. We publicly pretend to be free, whereas privately we obey. In both cases, we are victims of authority precisely when we think we have duped it. The cynical distance is empty, or true place is in the ritual of obeying, or as Kurt Vonnegut put it in his Modern Night, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be. In contrast to what the media desperately endeavor to convince us, the enemy today is not a fundamentalist, but a cynic. Even a certain form of deconstructionism partakes in the universal cynicism by proposing a more sophisticated version of the Cartesian provisional morality. In theory, in the academic practice of writing, deconstruct as much as you will and whatever you will, but in your everyday life, play the predominant social game. The present book was written with a view to bringing to public notice the nullity of cynical distance. Its subtitle is not to be taken ironically, it simply refers to the two divisions of each chapter, as it is indicated by their didactic titles. Why? The aim of each of the five chapters is to elucidate some fundamental Lacanian notion or theoretical complex. Letter, woman, repetition, phallus, father. In the first division of each chapter, Lacan is in Hollywood. That is, the notion or complex in question is explained by way of examples from Hollywood or popular culture in general. In the second division, we are out of Hollywood. That is, the same notion is elaborated as it is, in itself, in its inherent content. Or to put it in Hegelese, Hollywood is conceived as a phenomenology of the Lacanian spirit, its appearing for the common consciousness, whereas the second division is closer to the logic qua articulation of the notional content in and for itself.